Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, emerging from the darkness once again to take you inside the enigma known as the 2003 death of 38-year-old assistant U.S. attorney Jonathan Luna, who was found face down in a shallow stream underneath his car and with at least 36 puncture wounds on his body that were delivered by his own penknife. It's a baffling case, one where nothing is certain except mystery and this question: suicide or murder? We're going to examine the circumstances, including the legal issues preceding the event that many people believe precipitated this man's untimely death. But first, I want to run down the facts regarding what transpired on that fateful night of December 3, 2003, leading into the early morning hours of December 4th, when Jonathan Luna's body was found behind the Sensenig & Weaver Well Drilling Company. Now, on that particular evening, December 3rd, Luna is at his office in the Baltimore, Maryland courthouse, attempting to craft a plea deal prior to the next day's proceedings in a drug conspiracy trial involving two men he's supposed to prosecute. Due to complications we'll discuss later, he's forced to offer each of them a deal instead, and subsequently finds himself stuck at the office, struggling in an effort to put the logistics on paper. Around 11 p.m., Luna receives a call from his wife and tells her he's left the office, but that he has to go back. At 11:38 p.m., security footage at the courthouse garage shows his Honda Accord leaving. There are no obvious signs of distress, yet Luna leaves his cell phone and glasses on his desk in his wake. Indications are that he needed the glasses for driving. From there, Luna gets on Interstate 95 and drives north, eventually using his Easy Pass to pay the tolls at the first three interchanges before deciding to use paper tickets instead. At 12:57 a.m., he stops to use an ATM at JFK Plaza near Newark, Delaware, and withdraws $200 cash. At 2:37 a.m., Luna enters the New Jersey Turnpike at Interchange 6A from Route 130. One thing to note here is that this drive from the location of the ATM should have only taken about 45 minutes, meaning there's nearly an hour for which his actions are unknown. 10 minutes later, at 2:47 a.m., Luna crossed the Delaware River Toll Bridge and entered the PA Turnpike at Interchange 359, at which point the vehicle went west. Then, at approximately 3:20 a.m., Luna's debit card is used to make two gas purchases at the King of Prussia Service Plaza. In addition, an employee remembers Luna buying a bottled water and a soda, also claiming the attorney was alone and seemed calm. At 4:04 a.m., Luna's vehicle exits the turnpike once again at the Reading-Lancaster interchange. When this ticket was later recovered, it had a spot of blood on it belonging to Jonathan Luna. Of course, his exact whereabouts are unknown after exiting the turnpike, but we certainly know where he ends up. Sometime before sunrise, Luna's car pulls into the parking lot behind the Sensenig & Weaver Drilling Company, where it remains for a short time. Tire tracks suggest the car was moved again, this time right next to the shallow creek. Again, this waterway is little more than a trickle and looks like more of a drainage ditch than a flowing creek. If you tripped while standing in it and fell face first, your odds of not ending up underwater are incredibly good. Of course, this can vary during rainfall and times of drought, but under normal circumstances, it's not wider than a few feet, and perhaps no more than 1 foot deep. Regardless, Luna is ultimately found by a worker arriving at the company a short time later, around 5:30 a.m. At that time, it's reported that the Honda Accord has been driven over the embankment on one side of the creek, specifically the one bordering the parking lot, at which point it's abandoned. There's no indication the vehicle crashed into the creek bed. Rather, it seems to have simply been slowly driven over the edge from its original spot in the parking lot, finally coming to a rest with its front wheels hanging over the water. Of course, Jonathan Luna is found face down in the water, allegedly underneath his car in the area of the engine compartment. He sustained a total of 36 stab wounds, all inflicted by his own penknife, which is found next to a rock in the creek, only feet from the body. He has shallow stab wounds on the front of his torso, and also at least one on his back beneath the shoulder blades. According to the FBI, Jonathan did not have defensive wounds on his hands or arms. However, the local Lancaster County authorities, in addition to successive medical examiners performing autopsies, agreed that Luna's hands had been, quote, shredded as a result of the incident, causing him to be dressed in gloves for his funeral. Beyond that, there was significant slashing to the throat and scrotum. In totality, however, these injuries did not cause death, as the medical examiner found water in Luna's lungs, and the man was discovered face down. Drowning was listed as the official cause of death. The FBI maintains that Jonathan Luna likely committed suicide, while the determination at the local level is still homicide. No matter the truth, the death of Jonathan Luna remains a mystery. So let's dive into the psychology of this event. In much the same way we approached the Bryce Laspisa case, we're going to try to extract meaning from his movements in areas where we don't have evidentiary considerations to light the path ahead for us. So, on that night, Luna made a drive that should have only been 90 miles from Baltimore to Lancaster County, one that would have taken about 2 hours. To the contrary, however, Luna doesn't end up in the creek for about 5 hours. There's a pool of blood in the backseat of the car, especially on the floor, in addition to a significant amount of blood on the driver's seat. There's also blood on the outside of the driver's door, as well as the fender in front of it on that same side. Some of the cash previously withdrawn from the ATM is scattered on the back seat. For all intents and purposes, that's the extent of public knowledge. Anything else that transpired on the night of December 3rd, leading into morning on the 4th, whether inside or outside the car, remains unknown to this day. So, heading back to the start of events on the morning of December 3rd, here's what we do know. Luna was in the middle of prosecuting two defendants in a drug conspiracy trial. Now, I could spend the next half hour doing a complete rundown of the factual nuances of the case, but I sincerely don't believe it brings us to any type of revelation that clears up this matter in terms of motive for murder or the players involved. Essentially, Luna used a paid FBI informant named Warren Grace as a witness against the two defendants, Walter Poindexter and Dion Smith, and failed to disclose that fact during the proceedings. Not only that, but Smith had also violated the terms of similar agreements in the past. When the defense caught wind of the truth, this information was brought to light. The result is that Luna gets admonished by the judge for the inappropriate behavior, leaving him in a compromised position where he's forced to either continue with his misguided attempt to prosecute the defendants or show up the next day to offer each a plea deal. Either way, he loses and looks bad in the process. But here's the big problem. Luna just spent so much time convincing the courts that these two men were tied to a drug-related murder that now he's left drowning in the profound irony of having the responsibility to convince them that the opposite is true. After compiling all of this documentation to suggest the killing was directly the result of drug dealing, Luna leaves court that day, knowing he has only hours to undo that determination. From a practical standpoint, it's impossible. For all intents and purposes, he has to lie. And that's what we need to understand right from the start in this incident. No matter what happens after court on December 3rd, Jonathan Luna will have to tell a high-stakes lie, one that could cost him everything he's worked for. Even with that inconsistency alone, we already have reason for him to act desperately. So Jonathan goes back to his office at the Baltimore Federal Courthouse and starts writing the plea deals. Now, these two men, Poindexter and Smith, are looking at some very serious time in prison for their crimes. But he's already named one of them the trigger man in the killing and done everything he could to prove it was drug-related. Of course, the dilemma here is that it isn't legal to offer a plea deal to anyone being tried for a drug-related murder. You must prosecute. Yet, Luna doesn't have that option. So he writes the first plea agreement and starts the next one after that. The second of these two covers the trigger man in the incident, meaning it's the far greater challenge, one for which he doesn't have a solution. Accordingly, he makes it halfway through the document and then stops. And here we have a common problem accompanied by unusually high stakes. That problem, of course, is writer's block. Specifically this. Jonathan doesn't know what comes next. Not on paper. Not in his life. He's stuck in a moment that he can't get out of. Did you see what I did there? Good. But anyway, Jonathan Luna doesn't have a solution for this predicament. He's no closer to having the plea deals completed at 11:30 p.m. than he was while standing in court promising the judge he would arrive with them the next morning. The pressure is all on him. The defendants and their representation already know Luna's back is against the wall. They have the leverage at this point. What makes this so difficult for Jonathan is not the fact that it's illegal, as evidenced by his effort to present it to the judge as a solution anyhow, in addition to knowingly concealing damaging information about his informant Warren Grace, but that he's going to get caught for it and lose his career. People are going to notice he offered a plea deal on a drug-related murder charge, and it's likely going to cost him everything when it happens. This probably explains why those present in court, during these proceedings, claimed Luna seemed unprepared, distracted, forgetful, and generally not himself. So, the final plea deal is half written on his computer screen, and Luna has seemingly already lied to his wife by saying he had to go back to the office at 11 p.m., because there's no evidence he ever left until 11:38 p.m., when security footage shows his Honda Accord leaving the garage. However, when his vehicle does leave, his cell phone and glasses are left on his desk. In addition, he's already called another attorney to say he'd be dropping off documents related to the case in question, but he never does. By early the next morning, he's found dead. So the immediate inclination is to think he was murdered. If he wears glasses for driving and needs his phone to contact people, it seems reasonable he would have gone back to get them once he got to his car and realized he didn't have them for the drive ahead. But he doesn't. Now, I don't know the extent of the issues with his eyesight, but what's apparent to me from seeing numerous photos of him online is that I didn't see one where he was wearing glasses. I'm sure they exist, but every photo I saw depicted him without them. So it might not be fair to say, as is often suggested, that Jonathan Luna needed his glasses for driving. So, we also have his cell phone sitting on his desk. Of course, there's no sign of a struggle, and despite the fact that this happened in a federal courthouse building only 2 years post 9/11, there was very little security to speak of, if any. With that being the case, there isn't any way to prove if Jonathan was alone or accompanied by at least one other person when he left. We have no eyewitness accounts either, which isn't too strange given that it's nearly midnight. I have no doubt attorneys work into the night, or even overnight, but foot traffic during these hours would be very limited. So if Jonathan Luna left with others, he did so willingly. Security footage from the garage did not identify any vehicle that seemed to be following Luna's car, and from this point to the end of the night, according to the FBI, there is no reason to believe another person was in his presence. Local authorities differ in their opinion, of course, but I actually strongly side with the FBI in their conclusion. We can't say Luna left the courthouse alone, but with no signs of a struggle and no available motive, along with the security footage, it seems more likely that he did. Now, it's often suggested that somebody involved with the drug conspiracy case he was prosecuting at the time would have reason to kill him, but the opposite is actually true. As briefly discussed earlier, Luna gambled in trying to conceal the background of his informant Warren Grace and made a fool of himself. Rumors were swirling that his job was already in jeopardy, not only for misconduct and ineptitude connected to this case, but also actions related to a case the year prior. The controversy there is that Luna was one of the people who escorted some amount around $36,000 to $38,000 in seized money into an evidence vault, only to have someone discover it was missing shortly thereafter. Because of this, Luna was scheduled to take a polygraph in the coming weeks, with the questioning geared specifically toward the whereabouts of that cash. In 2018, it would be equivalent to about $51,785. But first we have to establish if Luna would take this money. Well, police learned soon after his death that he has more than $17,000 worth of debt on a credit card that his wife claims she knows nothing about. It's hard to say what the truth is there. She could be telling the truth. She could also be distancing herself from knowledge of the theft by also being ignorant of the debt that would warrant taking that risk. I think either of those two things is reasonable, and I'm not sure it matters that we don't know the truth. What matters to us is that Jonathan Luna is behaving erratically, specifically in a distracted manner, in the days leading up to this polygraph, and especially the hours preceding the expected delivery of the plea deals. In totality, we can see all of this is in relation to alleged misconduct. The defendants in this case are going to be offered outrageously reduced prison sentences that might as well have gift wrapping on the outside. Neither man has any reason whatsoever to prevent Luna from doing his job that night. Nor does anyone else. There's no motive present to perpetrate a violent crime against him. And here's where we get back to writer's block. Because it tells us what happens next. It's what always happens next. You step away from the screen. You run. And you don't come back until what? Until you know what happens next. But writer's block prevents the narrative from forming. And the reason is that it's an emotional issue that requires change. So if you won't change, you'll have to go out into the world and create false light to sell your bullshit narrative. But it's fake. We don't enjoy the shitty, misguided first draft of a depressed novelist any more than we do an emotionless performance on stage in a theater production. You sell a story through authenticity, by way of being human and vulnerable. You lose an audience when you manipulate, when you try to control perception. Jonathan Luna got his ass kicked in court earlier that day because he tried to sell a lie, and the audience made him pay for it. His only option left was to tell the truth. He couldn't do that. If he showed up the next day and continued prosecuting the two defendants, he would look absolutely ridiculous in the face of the lies about the informant. If he offered a plea deal, he'd break the law. The bottom line is that there wasn't a solution because he created a situation where the fallout of failure was greater than what he was willing to accept. That lie in court was going to cost him his job. In the aftermath of his death, the office denies it. But that's just something you do automatically to limit your liability. You don't say something like, "Yes, we were on the verge of firing him, and he knew it." Because there's potential for a perceived correlation between those words and his death. It isn't very difficult to see the damage was done, but he still wanted to avoid it. He wanted to have his cake and eat it too. That's why this ends up being so tragic for Jonathan. There was no solution. In the end, we see that very clearly. So let's continue that journey along his path here. So, with his crippling writer's block in tow, Jonathan sets out to create a new narrative that's not only conducive to avoiding his troubles that lie ahead the next morning in court, but also weeks later for the upcoming polygraph he has to take. And that's why it's so important to zoom in on nuance in this case, to measure movements carefully, beneath the lens of a microscope, rather than from afar. Now, he abandons his cell phone and keys, plus the responsibility of finishing the plea agreements. It's a fact that something is already stopping him from completing the plea deal. He has to lie, to contradict his earlier findings, at great risk to his professional life. The consequences could even extend to criminal penalties, especially the fallout from the potential theft. So, in the absence of any witnesses, or physical evidence suggesting an intruder entered the office and took him by force, we have reason to believe Jonathan Luna voluntarily stopped writing that document because he didn't have a solution for his dilemma. That means when we see his car leaving the garage alone at 11:38 p.m., he's likely the only person in it, and his intention, due to his writer's block, is to craft a new narrative that allows him to proceed without being caught in a catch-22 situation. But here's where he fails. He follows the same logic. And if this logic began with tragedy, guess how it's going to end? Face down in a creek by his own doing. He thinks another lie will undo the first lie from court, but only the truth can do that. What follows on this night is nothing more than a series of totally half-assed, half-hearted attempts at legitimizing a kidnapping situation intended to derail his accountability in the plea deals, gain sympathy from his office to salvage his career, and avoid the polygraph. He needed a solution to avoid all of these things. In the end, he found it. Jonathan Luna succumbed to shallow wounds and submersion in shallow water. But the inherent symbolism in pulling over at a well drilling company is that he had to dig deep within himself to find the truth. And the truth is that his desire to avoid the future could only happen one way. Death. The next morning was coming. The scrutiny at the office was mounting. The polygraph was on the horizon. Lies couldn't stop any of these things from happening. He tried anyway, making the most conservative moves possible, and it killed him. The greater tragedy, the lesson embedded within, is one he should have already learned. Two wrongs don't make a right. So let's watch it unfold. This is where the Honda Accord gets on the turnpike. So right away, I'm asking why. There's some speculation he might have been heading in the direction of a prison to see a prisoner, but that's a highly speculative conclusion. What we know for sure is that he couldn't finish the plea deal. So either somebody is in the car preventing him from doing it, or he's out in the world crafting the new narrative. So Luna drives north on the turnpike, paying for tolls with his Easy Pass. He stops at an ATM close to 1 a.m., more than an hour later, and withdraws $200 before getting back on the road. That's a fairly small amount of money. The ATM daily withdrawal limit back in those days would have been at least $500, so theft seems less likely to me. Aside from that, we don't have any witnesses to suggest anybody accompanied him. There's even cash on the back seat at the end of the event. I don't see any reason to believe Luna was forced into making that withdrawal. It doesn't happen for more than an hour after he leaves the courthouse. There's no urgency. It doesn't seem like anyone wants his money. They're not in a rush to get it, and they don't take it when they leave. But looking at the situation, what we can see for sure is this. Movement. We don't have any motive available for why a person would need to force Jonathan to drive this far. On the other hand, we also know this for sure. Nobody wants to get away from his computer, his life, and the next few weeks more than Jonathan Luna. Those things are all back in Baltimore. The culprit, whomever it might be, is driving away from there, and it's fairly obvious, through each step of the way, that there's no specific destination in mind. The Sensenig & Weaver Drilling Company doesn't bear any significance within that context. If you wanted Jonathan Luna dead, you could have killed him right there at his computer. It's a fact there were no witnesses that night. Instead, his vehicle drives aimlessly for close to 5 hours, and there's no narrative we can piece together that provides evidence of an abduction. From an emotional standpoint, Jonathan Luna had nowhere to go. He was trapped. The same goes physically. If he stayed, he had to face the music. The morning was only hours away. Notice that he lived the rest of the night, but died right before morning came. That's the amount of time Luna had left to run. It has no significance to any sort of kidnapper or killer. The reason we can't see this phantom chasing him, holding him hostage, torturing him, and finally taking his life, is because that missing element responsible for all of those things is the truth. He's running from the truth and not getting away. It's why he seems to have been abducted in a strange situation where we'll never have evidence of a kidnapper. It's because that actually happened. He is in a fight for his life. He's trying to escape the truth by redirecting light to create false perception in the eyes of others. He wants their sympathy, their forgiveness, to avoid condemnation. Sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes you're the Ramses or the McCanns. But other times, you're Jonathan Luna. You play with fire when you alter the truth. The main factor in all of that is risk. And that's the reason for the hesitation here. It's why Jonathan has to drive so far for no reason. What he's trying to come to terms with is the obvious notion that whatever prevents him from being in court the next day, and is also sufficient to prevent him from taking a polygraph weeks later, is going to have to be something extreme in nature. Now, if you've actually been kidnapped and can't make it, you won't have any problem proving it. And he knows that. But this shit isn't legitimate. That's where the hesitation comes in, where things start to get scary. Because the only way to prove that you were abducted and attacked is to commit an act of violence against yourself. Nothing else would be even remotely convincing. So you have to take extreme measures, but also be cautious in your approach. It's going to be very painful. It's going to be antithetical to your plight to survive, especially when you're not actually a suicide victim who's intentionally inflicting the wounds. You need to suffer, but you also need to live. Accordingly, stabbing yourself repeatedly with a penknife seems like a pretty good way to limit the damage while causing numerous wounds and blood loss. I mean, right now, just picture yourself trying to inflict a wound on your own torso with a full-sized kitchen knife. The thought is absolutely brutal. If you're trying to survive such a thing, that thought is even worse. Nobody would want to do that. Conversely, if you want to kill somebody and have motive, a penknife seems silly. It's messy, slow, and seems likely to antagonize the victim to a point he fights back. Plus, isn't it interesting that all of these wounds on Jonathan's arms and hands are described as defensive wounds, but he has none on his face? Apparently, this was an open casket funeral. I find it very hard to believe that an attacker with a penknife would have stabbed Jonathan 36 times and slashed his throat and scrotum, along with his hands and arms, but not once hit his face. Notice the penis isn't slashed either. Is that likely if a man is being attacked in the area of his crotch and trying to defend himself? With so much slashing to the scrotum, why is the penis free of damage? We can see an element of control here, of selective conservatism in relation to future considerations. Jonathan has a pretty baby face. He wants to keep it. He wants his penis, too. I can't blame him. These things benefit him. Not an abductor hell-bent on inflicting nightmarish torture. There's also no evidence of Jonathan's extremities wiping blood all over the interior of the vehicle as he fights back against the vicious assault. So we'll dig deeper into that statement as we get down the road, but let's proceed for now. Now, Jonathan has the cash, he leaves the ATM, and takes almost 2 hours to get to a location that's only 45 minutes away. This is where we see the beginning of the plan crumbling. He's already wandering. He doesn't have a specific goal to act upon. There isn't a story that's going to satisfy the needs of his plan. He reacted spontaneously by leaving the courthouse, but now he doesn't know what to do. So he drives around and finally stops at 3:20 a.m. to buy gas and a couple of drinks. Luna makes 2 gas purchases, and also buys 2 drinks, 1 water and 1 soda, but there's never any indication from anybody that he was accompanied by anyone. Again, the employee at the register said Luna seemed calm and normal. So what he's trying to imply with the two gas purchases is that he's being followed by another car. This is a safer bet because there's no way to definitively place somebody inside his own car. The physical evidence of such won't be there. Of course, look at the reality of this situation, though. It doesn't benefit the kidnapper. It benefits Luna. Luna can use the receipt to attempt to prove the presence of a second vehicle, but if you're the abductor, you wouldn't want that. Beyond that consideration, why would you want Luna to go into the store alone? He could easily tell the clerk what's going on. You could be identified. He could get help. It's just another example of something that benefits Luna, not a kidnapper. And that's why he's never able to successfully pull off this narrative. It's a flaming pile of shit. It's a desperate, last-minute Hail Mary to try to win the game. And it falls flat. So does he. But Luna's not even close to finish trying at this point. He gets back on the road. Now again, he stopped using his Easy Pass in favor of paper tickets, and the reason is that he needs to be able to pass on a ticket to the toll collector that has blood on it. He can't do that by Easy Pass. The reason Luna needs this to happen is that he has no actual destination. If he can prove he was bleeding in the car, then it says somebody else was in the vehicle and controlling his movements by way of attacking him. There was a persistent threat of violence. Otherwise, you can see what he's doing for exactly what it is: running away and seeking a solution. He has to be able to prove somebody removed him from his office against his will because he was supposed to be finishing the plea deals. The abductor needs to be the thing that stopped him from that specific activity. That's the whole point. But that fictional kidnapper also needs to be the reason somebody else finishes the plea deal while also excusing him from participation in the upcoming polygraph weeks down the line. Now, many people have speculated Luna was taking orders from somebody in the car and that there was a goal, that the kidnappers wanted something from the man. But he doesn't have his phone, and there's no record of him contacting anyone otherwise. There's no ransom or request for any kind of resources. There was nothing but silence from Jonathan Luna all night. It says he was alone. If you don't believe that, then you have to concede he was tortured over 5 hours in a situation that was extremely high risk for the kidnapper, but one where he miraculously wasn't seen by anybody and also made no demands of any kind. The fact is that we can't find a person who had anything to gain except Jonathan Luna. So, it's just after 4 a.m. when Luna exits the turnpike in Pennsylvania. If he doesn't take definitive action at this time to achieve his goal, the truth is going to come to light. Literally, that means all of the things he feared will now come to bear. There will be blood. But the tragedy that emerges from this is that the act will reveal the truth. The answer is clear. The only way for Jonathan to avoid the consequences is suicide. He's going to come to realize that at the end, but not before avoiding it by going through the motions of fabricating a kidnapping. There's very little planning, and it shows. He's basically driving around waiting for inspiration to strike, but it won't, because there isn't an answer that can help him other than this one. He has to injure himself badly in a situation where it seems as though somebody else attacked him and then fled. Would you want to do that to yourself? If you had to, but could avoid doing it for hours while you drove around considering other solutions, would you? Of course. This is terribly risky. Luna's a bright guy, but he isn't a surgeon or a medical professional of any kind. He's totally ignorant of what might happen. So at some point past 4 a.m., Jonathan Luna is driving through Denver, PA, We know he's bleeding prior to that time, but we don't know the extent of it. He could have had one finger pricked with the penknife blade, or he could have sustained all 36 stab wounds by that time. If I'm a kidnapper, why am I going through a toll booth with a man I've stabbed repeatedly who's bled on my ticket? That is so risky. It doesn't make much sense. Given that humans are conservative in their actions, I believe Luna likely fired off one or two stabs to his torso while on the road in order to produce the blood necessary for the spot on the ticket. Given that the ticket only had one spot on it, it stands to reason the blood flow was well under control at that time and not all over Luna's hands while driving. As stated, there doesn't seem to be any practical rhyme or reason for stopping at the Sensenigan Weaver Drilling Company. Nothing is dependent upon the location. You could argue the creek was attractive to the plight at hand, as it plays a role in the finality of the event, but what's more relevant to Luna's goal is that he needs to be found. The only caveat is this. He can't be seen fabricating the circumstances under which he'll be found. In that light, he needs to go somewhere private where he can ensure there are no witnesses, but also a place where someone will soon show up, because he's going to require help from someone who can verify how he was found. With the case being that Luna arrives at the company's parking lot well after 4, he can make a reasonable assumption he'll see somebody within a few hours, perhaps even before. He isn't going to be left for dead or calling for help at 10 a.m. That help will have long since arrived. So, we know his injuries have to be serious, and it has to appear as though he fought back. But again, we get a half-assed effort at proving this. He sustains numerous injuries to his hands and arms, but that's only half the equation. Where is the fight with another person? Where is the presence of abundant DNA in the car? It doesn't exist. We have a partial fingerprint that can't be verified, and a minuscule source of unidentified blood. While these things could be valuable, in truth they prove nothing more than anomalies, as we have a very violent, bloody incident in which the claustrophobic interior of the car was spared significant evidence suggesting the presence of another person. If this event actually happened, it was a fight inside a phone booth. But the evidence reported to us regarding the interior of the vehicle is far more suggestive of a man bleeding in the absence of another attacker's presence. Meanwhile, any suggestion that Luna couldn't have reached the area of his back beneath his shoulder blades to stab himself is laughable. He was long and thin, with long arms and a narrow torso. Jonathan Luna could have easily stabbed himself in the back. In fact, he did, literally and figuratively. It's not even funny. A natural reaction to getting attacked is to turn your face and body away from it. If you're in a position where you'd like to flee, but can't because you're trapped. With that being the case, we should see numerous wounds on Luna's back, especially considering the evidence shows he didn't fight back any more than putting up his hands and arms, if he legitimately did fight against an attack at all. Instead, the front of his torso is heavily favored. He doesn't seem to have turned away in agony at getting jabbed by the penknife. There's no mess of blood all over the door handles, windows, and locks from him trying to get out. And it's because he's the only aggressor in the car. So, someone trying to kill him would have been covered in blood, and imprints from his actions would be left all over the interior unless he wiped it down. But it's not wiped down, and we don't have any evidence of another person smearing blood all over the place. What occurs to me is that the most difficult hurdle for the local authorities, and the public for that matter, is that they simply can't believe somebody would do this to himself. Yet, I say you can't succumb to the desire to staunchly hold that ground. And for this reason, the evidence says you're wrong. He wasn't murdered. Who would do this to himself is not the right question. If you or I would do this to ourselves is also irrelevant. What matters is whether the evidence says Jonathan Luna behaved that way. It does. We can't account for a second person, or even a motive. But we do know he was desperate. We do know he told lies in high-stakes games. And we also know he was failing in these endeavors, with increasing consequence. That's how his day went. Like a compulsive gambler sitting at a table in a casino, watching his stack dwindle to zero, Jonathan navigates his day, avoiding the truth, which is this. He's gambling and losing. Soon enough, he'll have nothing. And it really does end that way. It doesn't end with someone else gaining anything. There is no house. There is no other player. We don't know who would want to torture him. The defendants were getting an outstanding plea deal. In fact, someone else in Luna's office finished the plea agreements for him and managed to present the murder as something other than a drug-related crime. It makes me wonder why Luna was so paranoid about submitting this deal in court when someone else had no reservations at all. The obvious answer is that Luna had considerations at play which were extraneous to the trial at hand, specifically the missing $30-some thousand from another case that disappeared after being in his possession during transport. He had a lot of eyes on him. He clearly didn't think he could sweep this thing under the rug and worried it would come back to haunt him when the unfavorable results of the polygraph inevitably came to light. If he took the money, and it was proven, he would have lost his job, gotten disbarred, and potentially faced criminal penalties. That's quite a departure from being an assistant U.S. attorney. Basically, this guy was going to be ruined. And he had a family, including a wife and kids. The pressure to escape that fate is enormous. Accordingly, the desperation is going to be tantamount. So let's see how this unfolds at the end of the night, leading up to Luna's death. The car pulls into the Sensenig & Weaver Drilling Company in Denver, PA, parking in the lot out back. It's believed that it remained there with the engine running for a while, at which point it was driven over into the creek running alongside the lot. Again, it didn't have a violent crash into the creek bed. It was driven over the creek's edge, and the front tires were hanging over the water. So, we have blood all over the back seat, including a pool of it on the floor. It's most often suggested that this indicates Luna was riding in the back seat of the car the whole way, but that logic is faulty. Had he been doing that, you'd be forced to concede there were at least two other people in the car with him, making it even more likely that significant evidence of attackers would be found. A single person couldn't drive the car and control a grown man in the back with a penknife at the same time. That's definitely not a recipe for success. Just in terms of leverage, the person in back would be very likely to overpower the driver and take the weapon. Now, we also have a significant amount of blood in the driver's seat, but not a pool like in the back. It's also suggested that Luna likely got out of the back seat, where he was being attacked, and fled into the driver's seat, where he took off with the car, before crashing it into the creek. But all of this is incredibly silly. The logic doesn't hold up one bit. There was no indication anyone tried to avoid driving the car into the creek. It seemed to have been driven straight and slowly over the embankment. It was not traveling at a high rate of speed, or with any other intention. The pool of blood in the back seat says Luna inflicted most of the stab wounds back there. It's far more spacious, and it's at this time he needs to make it seem as though someone was in his vehicle, other than him, because he simply hasn't proven the existence of a second vehicle. The two gas purchases proves nothing. So getting in the back to stab himself makes more sense. We know he's already stabbed himself, as evidenced by the toll ticket, but we don't know the damage. And you have to remember something. I never hear anybody talk about this. But just imagine how sad and angry this man is that his actions have brought him to this point. He's alone, afraid. He's reached the end of the line. No one can help. But there's also no going back. He has to go through with it. It's truly pathetic. He knows it doesn't look like someone else was involved. And he hates himself for it. And he's not just putting himself through this. His family is going to suffer too. It's all his fault. But he isn't going to turn around, head back, and tell the truth. He's come too far. He's committed the lie. Now he'll do his best to prove it. Of course, authorities go on to say that many of the wounds are superficial, to the extent they're described as hesitation wounds that barely break the surface. It's been reported that half of the wounds were stabs to the neck. Again, notice your first inclination. How could he do that to himself? There's no way. I'm thinking it too. But then I go right back to my previous point. He doesn't have facial wounds. How on earth could you be stabbed in the neck 18 times without sustaining any damage to your face? Our bodies are designed to allow us to lower our chins to protect the throat and upper chest area from predators' teeth and other human weapons. If you're getting stabbed in the neck, you don't hold your head back like somebody's giving you a tattoo in that spot and you need to hold still. If a person, or two people, had been holding Luna in place, the police would have easily ascertained such a thing through DNA evidence inside the car. It never happens. But what does happen is that Luna punctures his carotid artery with one of these stab wounds to the neck, despite the fact that it's shallow. He wouldn't know that right away, because the wound isn't huge, but he's minutes from bleeding out. Of course, had you attacked him in this way, you also wouldn't know the wound was fatal. There's no indication this particular wound was more pronounced in its intent than the others, meaning that it wasn't a death blow. It was also shallow. So if somebody fled the scene, they did so believing Luna was still alive and could identify them. But that didn't happen. There was no second person. I'll show you why. The most blood was in the back seat and on the floor. This means the bulk of the stabbing happened in that spot. Given that the police discovered blood had also dripped through the driver's seat onto the back seat floor, it's reasonable to assert that Luna did indeed get back into the driver's seat after being badly wounded and operated the car. With his condition dictating he's rapidly losing blood, his consciousness is also soon to go. Accordingly, what we find is that the car is driven over the edge of the creek embankment so that the front tires teeter over the shallow water in the creek below. So, the car's undercarriage, in the area of the engine, is hovering over the shallow creek. If we assume Luna is in the car when it comes to a halt there, which seems intentional, it's also reasonable to suggest he gets out, shuts the door, and rapidly losing consciousness, stumbles along the outside of the driver's door, leaving the blood in question. He then makes it along the left fender, toward the creek, leaving that blood evidence in his wake. At this point, he's headed down the creek embankment, which is only several feet, and falls over face first in the water due to blood loss. It's there he loses consciousness and drowns soon after. There was a small head wound reported, but that seems consistent with falling face first in a shallow creek full of rocks. It was never concluded that he was struck with any type of object by another person. In the end, the body is lying underneath the car's engine. It's not more than 1 to 2 hours before it's found by workers at the company when it opens for the day. So, I think the big question here is this. At what point did this go from being a fabricated kidnapping to turning into a suicide? Or did that even happen? Did Luna really just go too far with one of the stab wounds to the neck? That's possible. He also could have decided during the stabbing that there was no going back at all. I say that because it's true. If he survived this event, he would have been exposed in the most embarrassing way possible. He'd have to suffer all of the trauma of a victim, but be ridiculed and treated as an outcast. That's before considering criminal punishment. This story didn't hold up at all. Whatever he had concocted in his mind wasn't playing out in the real world. Because it was a lie. Because he was unprepared. Just like he'd been in court that morning when he couldn't stop the proverbial bleeding, the lie he told to escape that truth resulted in the same type of death. Symbolism follows you everywhere. It's reflected in your actions, quite literally. If you look at the symbolism here, it's apparent Jonathan Luna couldn't see what he was doing until it was too late. Accordingly, he was unable to call for help. So isn't it interesting, then, that the decision to leave his glasses and phone behind were the elements that kicked off the false story? Again, we have tragedy. He couldn't call for help. He couldn't see what he had done until it was too late. The local police can call this a mystery all they want. I'm siding with the FBI's claim that this was likely a false kidnapping plot or a suicide, but I'm specifically saying it was a botched kidnapping plot that left Luna with the realization he had nowhere to run. If he didn't inflict the fatal wound intentionally, it's also fair to say he didn't prevent himself from stabbing in that area fewer than 18 times. There's a reason. Whether or not he knew it before it happened is a secret we'll never know. This case is a prime example of why I say suicide is not a black and white issue. It's far more complicated and often arises due to circumstance rather than plotting or a simple decision. Not every cliff we jump off involves a single decision for which there is no going back. Sometimes that cliff is a series of decisions that leaves us drowning in the waters below. Either way, as mentioned, the symbolism is far too apparent here. Jonathan Luna, in his last moments on Earth, when it all came crashing down, told us the truth. He was drowning, and he wanted it all to end. And when I think of it that way, when I throw away this shit about another person being in the car, only then do I see an attack. Only then do I see the truth. Only then do I understand that Jonathan Luna was a victim. Maybe the circumstances were within his control. Maybe he could have acted differently. But he didn't. And there was no going back. That hurts. It truly fucking hurts. Because I've been there. Maybe I've passed you on my way. That's right. I'm sure you've been to that place too. That dead end. In your heart. Your mind. In the eyes of others. When you ask, what the hell did I do? That place where you can't go back, but you can't go forward, so you just hide. Some of us have been there and come back to face the consequences, while others continue to run into perpetuity, never looking back over their shoulders. Even still, many of us are both of these people, alternately running and facing the music, losing our sanity within. But on this night, Jonathan Luna chose silence. And as it brought forth the truth, he was no longer falsely redirecting light. In turn, the universe granted his final wish, bestowing upon him silence and peace. Forever. Jonathan Luna never compromised himself in court the next morning. He never falsified the plea deals, nor did he face questioning weeks later in a polygraph. The only thing that would have relieved him of these duties was what happened. Death. I think the pressure probably got to him. It's rumored that, on top of the other issues I've already mentioned, he was helping to care for two elderly parents living in South Carolina, and they'd been residing in a tiny basement apartment. As the debt mounted, it probably seemed to him like nobody would miss the small amount of $30-some thousand. But they did. What Jonathan Luda couldn't see, as he fell apart down the stretch, is that he was the one slipping, not everybody else. But he acted as though other people could be easily fooled. The tragedy is that he lied to himself. He was the one who could be easily fooled. So when he went overboard and drowned, there was nobody around to help. Because he jumped ship from a place of isolation, of lies, of a logic all his own. If you look at the culmination of the story closely, and within that context, what you see is that Jonathan Luna, upon going too far, whether by choice or accident, decided to drive the car from the lot to the creek. And here's why. The penknife only has his fingerprints on it, and he's going to die with it in his hand. By getting to the creek and managing to make it down the embankment, dropping the weapon into the water, and washing away other potentially crucial evidence, he negates definitive proof he inflicted the wounds in question. In that light, his death remains a mystery. But no matter what, there was no going back. That's a hard fact of life we learn at an early age, one that's relevant until death. Actions can't be taken back, and lies can never be untold. Those are two elements we're all unable to reconcile in life on Earth. The finality of it is dreadfully painful. It makes us want to run and hide, to a place of peace and isolation, where no one can ever find us. But we all come to learn that place doesn't exist. They'll get you. The monsters are real. I remember when I came to understand this for the first time, that the world we live in is not black and white, that the line between right and wrong is often blurred and even more often dangerous and unpredictable. It wasn't a straight line to the truth. If the truth even existed. I remember running to my happy place, thinking I was safe there, that they wouldn't find me, that I'd never come back. I was about 3 or 4 years old, and my mom had taken me and my older brother to a friend's house to play. We got along well with these kids, both of whom were little girls, one a year younger than I, and one my brother's age at 3 years my elder. What I noticed right away is that my mom was overly thrilled to be friends with the woman who lived there, and I felt like it had something to do with her ascending to a social stratosphere she couldn't have predicted. She was being accepted by these people as a peer, and proud of it. On this particular day, however, we were throwing rocks in the backyard, specifically at a tree that was a good distance away. There was nobody in that direction. In fact, it was only woods. But somehow the younger sister crept around the woods, through the weeds and trees, to hide out behind the tree where we were throwing rocks. Again, she was a year younger, and barely able to realize her mistake. Anyway, she wanted to scare me, and timed herself to jump out from behind the tree and yell right before I threw the rock, thereby stopping me in my tracks and getting a great laugh. But when she jumped out, I had actually just let go of the rock. I remember seeing it leave my hand and staring at the big smile on her face as she thought she had perfectly timed this joke. But the smile faded instantly. and that rock hit her square in one eye, splitting it open and sending blood spraying everywhere. She screamed in horror, and even more so from the pain. I ran, as fast as I could. I hid in the woods, behind a log where nobody would find me. And they were calling me. One by one, they all joined. My brother, her sister, then my mom, her mom, a few neighbors. Soon enough, it was a witch hunt. It went on for hours. I could hear my mother crying. The ambulance came and took the girl away wailing. All I could think of was the blood and the damage to her face. It would always be there. It would always be my fault. I didn't mean to do it. None of that mattered, though. The consequences weren't going to disappear. I had never been so fucking afraid in my life. And I haven't been since that day. For years, my terror was due to the fact that perhaps people thought I had done it purposely. And I always believed that's why my mother was no longer friends with this woman. Because there was an obvious mistake. If she could just understand that it was an accident, even for a second, everything could be forgiven. Everything could go back to normal. But life doesn't work that way. And that's what I hid from. For as long as I could. When darkness began to fill the forest, and cold swept across my skin, I realized the most important lesson I've ever learned in this world. There's nowhere to hide. Not behind a tree. Not in a courtroom. And certainly not in the midst of a lie. You'll get exposed, like we all do, for being frauds and failures, right or wrong. Each one of us is evil. So I think the only truth that we ever really know for sure is this. Sometimes you throw the rock. Sometimes you get hit, but you're always human. You're destined to feel the sharp end of the knife coming at you, again and again. So I think the lesson learned is that it's no less painful to inflict the damage than it is to sustain it. Buried in that truth is the answer to why Jonathan Luna took his life. We just had to drill down below the surface to see it. Maybe that's the message.